Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Baseball season is around the corner, and we will be giving out our favorite futures picks on the Just Baseball Show in the lead up to opening day. To go along with that, BetMGM has a brand new offer for our listeners. Use code JUSTBASEBALL and place your first BetMGM Sportsbook wager through the BetMGM Sportsbook app of at least $5, and you will receive $150 instantly in additional winnings regardless of your wager's outcome. How to get this offer? Step 1. Download the BetMGM Sports app on iOS or Android or visit BetMGM.com. Step 2. Sign up and deposit at least $5 into your newly created account. Step 3. Place a wager in the amount of at least $5 at standard odds price. Step 4. Once you have placed a bet, you will receive $150 in bonus bets regardless of the outcome of your wager. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY to 467-369 in New York and call 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 21 plus only, please gamble responsibly. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona, 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa, and 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use code JUSTBASEBALL and get $150 when you bet at least $5 on your first wager.
And Bonds, high. It's a game!
Busy weekend leads us into a new week on the Just Baseball Show. We got Pat Bailey, one of the best defensive catchers in Major League Baseball, on the back half of this with Aram and Peter. I'm Jack. Aram's with me to talk about Mookie Betts, a whole bunch of young shortstops, and then his favorite team's new favorite pitcher, AJ Puck, on the back end. Just Baseball Show for Monday, March 11th, as always, presented by BetMGM. This was, I sent you a list of 5-6 topics, and then you were like, oh, and we got to talk about this, and we got to talk about this, and we got to talk about this. Welcome to baseball season, where we have stuff to talk about.
And welcome to the, I think, like, we're in the red zone, you know, of the off season. And I know it's not really the off season when spring training starts, but to me, everything where that's not opening day or the World Series, the final game of the World Series, is technically the off season. I feel like this is the red zone where, like, any other moves that need to be made are either going to be made in the next week or it's going to be too late and you take the field goal. Like, I think Blake Snell might end up taking the field goal, right? And we're going to see him, you know, maybe a month or two into the season at this rate. So it's like a lot of things that are getting pushed in at the buzzer, a lot of different moves, and also a lot of decisions that have to be made. And they don't need to necessarily be made now, but I think right around this time of spring training, you start to see, you know, how dialed in some of these teams are in terms of, you know, can this rookie actually make the team? And their usage of that player, you know, is he batting at the top of the order every single day like Jackson Holliday has? You know, I think we start to see an idea of, okay, they're really serious about this guy potentially making the team. And we're seeing that with a few guys now.
100%. We're going to talk about Jackson Holliday. We are going to talk about a guy that was at or near the top or middle of the lineup pretty much every day for Cincinnati that is now not going to be there for at least the front half of the season. There is one note as to why I still fully consider this the offseason. Did you see the Blake Snell Instagram flurry that we got on Sunday? If we're getting Instagram like newsers, it's still the offseason.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I only saw one picture with like the eyeballs emoji. Like, if we're tracking people's social media, the season ain't started yet.
No.
That's definitely a good indicator. I guess if Snell's tweeting the little eyeball emojis, either he's just not getting enough attention right now at home, or something is close. But even if something was close, I don't know if I'd ever see myself being the tweeting eyeball emoji guy before something's about to happen. Maybe he's just that sick of everybody saying like, oh, when's Snell going to sign? When's Snell going to sign? But I don't know. Like, and I'm not trying to get on my high horse here or anything like that. I just don't think I'd ever be the eyeball emoji guy in relation to my own decision that I can make on my own timeline.
Yeah. Thing is, I don't know enough about Blake Snell. Like, there are obviously guys in the game that are eyeball emoji on the Instagram story 6 hours before they sign. And then there are guys that just throw it up there out of nowhere to screw with people. And
that's like, pretty funny. See, that it is, part's funny.
Like, Jock Peterson posting that Phillies thing was funny in hindsight. I don't know which one Blake Snell is.
Yeah, that's a great question. He could be either way. I could see him one way or another. I guess we'll find out.
We'll find out.
If he doesn't sign anytime soon, I respect him more.
Yeah. Can I ask you a quick question? What does permanent for now mean?
Okay. I watched the whole presser, which is rare. I honestly don't. I'll watch like a little bit of it, but somebody posted the whole presser on Twitter. It was like, 2.5 minutes or whatever it was. And it was the reporter that loaded the question saying, is this a move that's permanent for now? Basically giving Dave just an easy get out, there, because you can give this 1 foot in, 1 foot out answer. So that was basically, you gave him a life raft to get out of there and not have to be committal. If you said, is this permanent? Would have been much more interesting to see what Robert says. But because he said, is it permanent for now? He basically gave him a get out of jail free card, which is, can you basically give a wishy-washy answer? Because that was the one issue there. Is I get what he was saying. Like, is this what is going to be happening daily?
Yeah.
For now? But I would have loved a little bit more of a definitive answer. So asking, is this permanent, would have definitely given us a little bit more context to what the decision actually is. But I think it's pretty clear it's permanent until further notice. So I guess that is what they were getting at.
But doesn't permanent until further notice also mean temporary? The literal definition of permanent for now means temporary.
Is anything it could really be permanent, if you really think about it?
A Sharpie's permanent. It doesn't sound like he's Sharpied. And we're talking about Mookie Betts playing shortstop, by the way. This was the report. And Dave Roberts was asked about the switch for Mookie Betts going to shortstop full time. And he said permanent for now.
I think, like, if you look at it from any player's perspective, no player is permanent. Even, Bryce Harper wants an extension because his deal isn't permanent enough. I think it's interesting. Like, I know what they're getting at. I think the point is until the Dodgers go out and get a shortstop outside of their organization, Mookie Betts will be playing shortstop. And that's because Gavin Lux, clearly just is not ready to take that role on. And I feel for him because he looked like he was as ready as he has ever been last year before he tears his ACL. And now, there's some people that, believe that I've seen on social media kind of allegedly saying that he has the yips. And honestly, like, I haven't seen anything on it, but I've watched him make some throws. He definitely doesn't look comfortable. And Dave Roberts said, we're putting him in an area at second base where it's easier to make the throw, essentially. So Roberts didn't do anything to help that, in terms of I think Lux's perspective. So I think that's interesting. I think he's having some trouble throwing the ball right now. I don't know if there's any doubt about it. I watched him spike a double play that he turned from second base as well. Like, he's definitely going through it, throwing the ball. And then, obviously it's not riding a bike. Like, it takes some time to get fully in the swing of things hitting wise. But you know, there was already questions around Lux anyways. We've talked about it in the past how, you know, I think a lot of the scouting reports on him were a little bit off. There wasn't as much emphasis on StatCast and I think data in general. Yeah. When he was doing the things that he was doing, because he was enjoying a nice PCL bump, putting up really good power numbers. And I think we saw some, you know, major outlets give him double plus power grades, and he just doesn't have that. If you go back and look at the exit velocities, he's never posted even plus exit velocities. So I think it's a combination here of, you know, scouting reports probably being a little bit too juiced on him in the past, and then you also have a situation where it's a guy that's been banged up, and I think a guy that's battling some internal struggles, I think, in terms of confidence and some things with his game. And it's pretty hard to, when you're on a team like that, that, you know, is the show of Major League Baseball, right? I mean, they are the big thing, and you still haven't even proven yourself as a big leaguer yet, and you're trying to capture that shortstop job. I could see how the pressure could mount.
Yeah, I'm blanking on the year that he had the yips. It might have been 2020, where he played only 19 games, but he did battle of the yips, and that was pretty well documented at some point very early in his major league career. I think it was 2020 after a 23 game sample in 2019. So you've got that, you put him back at that problem area. I will say, in terms of lineup construction, this was the perfect move, because you put Mookie Betts at shortstop. The one glaring deficiency was shortstop for the LA Dodgers, and you had Lux. I thought Tim Anderson was a perfect fit on the short end of that platoon. They didn't do it. So then who can play shortstop? Do you put Kike at shortstop? Like, no. He lost a step. Chris Taylor has lost a step. Kike and Chris Taylor filling in at second base with Mookie Betts as the everyday shortstop makes me feel so much better than Mookie at second and then figuring something out at shortstop.
You know, my only thing is, though, with this whole situation is, it does reek a little bit of some desperation, because and desperation's relative here.
Yeah, the best team in baseball has a desperate spot.
And it's a pretty important spot. Yes. My problem is, and again, this isn't saying that the Dodgers wouldn't be good regardless, but you know, I think they could roll Miguel Rojas out there and they'd be fine. But yeah. I think it's interesting that Mookie Betts was always going to be moved to second base, you know, going into this year. Yeah. To preserve his health, right? A little bit of ailments that they want to keep him fresh and keep him right. Now you move him to the most demanding position in the infield. You know, and I know the outfield, I think it was a little bit of a back thing, if I'm not mistaken, that they wanted him to be kind of comfortable from. And I understand how the outfield can be, you know, disruptive to that. But I just think it's crazy that the whole point was to preserve, you know, one of the best players in Major League Baseball. And then now, okay, we don't have a shortstop. Mookie, you're up. And I get it. He is the best option. But as Peter wanted us to mention on the podcast, he hasn't played shortstop regularly. What, since high school?
Senior in high school. He mentioned that on base with Dan.
And that's not to say he's not capable. Of course, he's capable. But is his body capable of holding up when doing that for, you know, 140, 150 games this year? So that my one thing is I hope that they give him a day off a week from shortstop at the very least and don't run him into the ground. Because one, the sport's better when Mookie Betts is healthy. And, you know, I don't ever want to look back at Mookie Betts' career and say, oh, man, if he was healthy. So that's my one thing is I'm sure they've got a plan for it. But, you know, the whole point was to preserve Mookie. And I don't want some 11th hour, oh, shit, we don't have a shortstop situation. Yeah. You know, results in them kind of churning Mookie too much, which is why I think they're going to end up going out and getting a shortstop.
Yeah.
Now, I think they just don't want to press and rush, you know, and force themselves to make a trade where they don't have any leverage. But, you know, if Mookie's playing shortstop for a couple months and then they get the opportunity to go trade for somebody, we know they got the farm. They can go get a shortstop there and maybe that makes sense.
100%. Maybe they have somebody step up in Double A that we're not thinking about, although those guys are kind of gone. Like Vivas is gone. Eddie Slaynard is gone. All the shortstop prospects that we thought were coming down the pipe in 2021, 22, even a guy like Leonel Valera, like gone. All those guys just disappeared. And now you have what, four catchers that you love and an outfielder that you love and then a billion pitchers again. So it is fascinating. And I mean, at the end of the day, they still are the best team in baseball. And Mookie Betts, the day after this is announced, he has Dansby Swanson on his podcast. So, like, he's going to be armed. I think Mookie Betts is going to be A-okay.
He's going to be great. And that's the thing. I think he's going to be great. Again, it's just more about, does the body hold up? But I'm excited. I mean, it's just fun to have one of the best players in the game at such a premium position, right, which is really fun. The last thing I'll say is, I think this makes sense as to why either the Red Sox, I'm thinking Mookie Betts, Red Sox. Sorry, Red Sox fans. I'm thinking about the trade that we saw between the Yankees and the Dodgers, right? That 40-man crunch trade where Vivas does go to New York.
And Sweeney goes to LA.
Trey Sweeney goes to LA. The difference is Vivas probably a better bat at this stage and a higher floor bat, but Sweeney can actually play on the left side of the infield. So maybe that was part of the reason too. Still a little ways away, but you never know if something really clicks for him in an organization that generally helps, you know, hitters click.
Does Miguel Vargas make the roster? That's my last thing.
I'd have to look at like the whole roster situation. I would like to see that. It just seems like if not, move him. And maybe that's a guy that you could end up moving for more of a true shortstop. There's a lot of teams in baseball, I think, that could justify giving Vargas, an opening day spot and run him out there every day. I think he's going to hit. I've still always liked him, but where does he fit in is kind of the question.
No idea. A guy that will not be fitting into the Reds' plans and did play shortstop through the minor leagues last year. We saw him get his shot at third base. He looked good enough to make his debut and graduate from prospect ranks. Noelvi Marte was banned 80 games for the use of a performance-enhancing substance. That's a tough blow for a team that was going to run out a ton of sophomores, and Noelvi Marte was going to be another one of those guys. He might have still had rookie eligibility. Regardless, they got a deal with that opening at third base. He was going to be the everyday third baseman, and Candelario was going to play first base. Now I assume Candelario moves over to third. You got CES playing first base full-time. At the end of the day, this sucks for a guy who clearly needed to have a massive year to cement himself as a future star. We had our doubts. Last year, he quelled some of those doubts. This year was going to be massive. And now all the questions are going to start to creep right back in.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of my concerns were about, kind of some of the athleticism in the body. It had backed up on him, especially when I saw him in the Arizona Fall League. And then he was in better shape last year. He looked more physical. He looked like he was in a better position, and he played really well. I did have some concerns, and I, like you said, I think he quelled those. But now you kind of wonder what it looks like. You know, how much was he benefiting from this? Is it the classic, I didn't know what I was taking? I don't know, because that body did change pretty quickly. If there's one team that can, you know, be okay without their young third baseman who was penciled in, I mean, the Reds are one of them for sure, because of it was already a cluttered infield in a good way. And that Candelario signing, as you mentioned, just looks so much better now. I already thought it was a great value. I thought it was weird that was a polarizing signing. You look at the price there. I thought it was a good deal. Yeah. But now, man, they got to be really happy that they pulled that off, because you got CES, as you mentioned, who slides over to first. Of course, the upside of Marte is extremely exciting. But odds are Candelario, you know, given what he's done every year and what you can kind of expect from him, and not every year, I guess, because he's had some ups and downs, but I would have probably bet on a full 162 if you're picking one or the other. It's safer to say Candelario has the better season. Yes. And you know, now he's just going to get more regular reps at a different spot, and CES slides over. I think the Reds, it doesn't really change their outlook too much. I think it's more about what it means for Noelvi Marte, a key piece in you know, their long-term outlook, and just the idea of having this young core growing together. This does kind of put a little bit of a fracture in it, but the other guys will keep going.
Now, do you think there's a world where they could kind of alter the assortment? As of right now, we're thinking it's going to be Candelario at third, Elliott short, McClain at second, CES at first, India DHing. Do you think there's a world where they move Ellie back to third base, where he could profile better long-term, McClain to shortstop, where he can really handle his shit, India at second, Candelario at first, CES DHing? Do you think that assortment could make any sense, or is it, hey, we're doing the Pirates thing with O'Neill Cruz, who we'll actually talk about a little bit later on, where Ellie De La Cruz is the shortstop. That's where we sell our tickets. That's where we sell our jerseys. Ellie's going to play short, and we'll figure it out from there.
I think that the latter probably makes the most sense. I think we'll see them mix it up a little bit, though, because remember, Ellie's not as great, not as good from the right side. Fraley would probably grab that DH spot as well. So maybe when we see a left-handed you know, left-handed pitcher, they mix and match a little bit differently here and there. I'd imagine that they want Ellie to just play all the time anyways, but
right.
there could be lineups that they put together to negate some of the platoon situation. And that's where we could see that kind of infield alignment. But I'm imagining, you know, you swap the DH spot, you know, you get Fraley out of there. They can kind of mix and match a little bit more, but it does, they still have some versatility, which is nice. And I think the fact that Steer can play multiple positions, the fact that you have McClain, that's pretty comfortable at third, short or second. I think they're able to kind of mix and match and figure things out. But I am really fascinated to see how they handle this, because I do think there's a difference between what may be the best defense and what may be the most marketable and frequent defense that we see alignment wise. And that's not a knock on Ellie.
No,
it's just putting everybody at their best position.
Well, and that's also the reality of playing in a small market. Small market teams need to put the best brand on the field. And is that the best defensive alignment? Maybe not. Is that the best offensive product? Probably. They'll figure out a way to get the nine best bats in the lineup on an everyday basis. That's the goal of the game. But they're also looking to sell out Great American Ballpark. And when Ellie Mania was at full throat last year, they were selling out Great American Ballpark. They're going to try and capture that magic again. And that will happen with Ellie De La Cruz at shortstop.
Who's very fine there, but I will say, you know, you look at the numbers, you watch the video. McClain is just more consistent at the position at this stage.
Yeah. The best product, I think, regardless of talent, marketability, however you want to slice it, the best product at Camden Yards this year will be with Jackson Holliday in the opening day lineup as the second baseman. And it was an 0-2 pitch. Passan tweeted out the scenario. 0-2 pitch, 95-mile-an-hour fastball elevated from Yusei Kikuchi, so left on left, and Jackson Holliday with a pull-side grand slam. It's your daily Jackson Holliday update, but I think we're all but confirmed that Jackson Holliday's in the opening day lineup for the Baltimore Orioles.
Yeah, he's forced their hand. It's just, you know, it's one of those things where you can't justify any other decision at this point. And that's another infield. I'm really fascinated to see how they get everybody, you know, some run and what kind of moves that they make to maybe clear up some space. Because now that Holliday's almost surely going to start the year there, like, a Ramon Urias, like, it's a good player, man. But, like, where does he fit in when you've got Westberg? And, you know, you've even a Jorge Mateo, like, he's going to get some runs still.
And, dude, still like him. Can we acknowledge Kobe Mayo's existence and his production in spring training?
And if it weren't for Jackson Holliday, Kobe Mayo would be the talk of Baltimore right now. I mean, that guy is mashing, too. And guess what? I'm glad you brought him up. He just did it in AAA last year. Like, he absolutely mashed there and got better and better as the year went on. So, and that's a guy that can play third. Can play first. They may even try to run him out in the corner outfield just to find a spot to fit him in. By the way, Colton Cowser has made some adjustments.
Killing.
Looks like he is much more comfortable and looks solid. Kyle Stowers looks healthy. It is a really fascinating situation here. I'm very happy that they went out and got Corbin Burnes, even though he got knocked around a little bit today. Not worried about that, though.
Starter. No. Yeah, Hyde already announced it. Like, we're good.
Yeah, I think it's fine. But, you know, they still have an embarrassment of riches, and they still need to figure out, you know, how to make room for some of these guys. So it's going to be interesting. And Jackson Holliday forcing their hand only makes it that much more difficult.
Yeah. No room in Arizona for Jordan Lawler. He's headed back to the biggest little city in the world in Reno, Nevada. He's going to be an ace again. Jordan Lawler, it was announced that he will start the year in AAA. We knew it. We knew that Perdomo was going to be the guy. It still just kind of stinks to see it. I've got no takeaway except, hey, it's final now. Time to, you know, rip the cover off the ball for a month, because if Perdomo is OPSing 620 for the first month, like he did after that out-of-body experience for the first 2 months of the year, then, like, here we go, man. It's your job.
100%. And I think Perdomo did earn, especially with his postseason performance, earn the opportunity to start the year at shortstop. And you know, yes, he fell off a cliff a little bit through the remainder of the season, but still put together a good year. And then again, I think the finishing strong in the postseason and having some really big at-bats for them and making some big plays, I think, you know, earned him that opportunity. But also Jordan Lawler looked a little bit overmatched. He's one of the best prospects in baseball. He's 21 years old. Like, you're right. He's going to be really good, but I don't think he's ready just yet. And he barely played in AAA, right? It was a quick bump to AAA, and then they ran him up, and understandably so. He's a great defender. They wanted somebody to kind of take over the Nick Ahmed role, and they figured he couldn't be worse. Turns out, I mean, it was pretty comparable because of how overmatched he was, but you figured you had a great defender, a guy that's faster at least. You have your your Jerod Dyson runner at the very least in the postseason as well. But, you know, Jordan Lawler has the potential to be an all-star and a perennial one at that. You know, he's probably going to settle somewhere in the middle. But I saw a guy that was really struggling with breaking balls, really struggling to stay on it and pick up spin, and was pressing. Like, a big part of what makes him so good is he's very selective. He's drawn plenty of walks. His chase rate's always been around, you know, below 20%, at least over the last season and a half. So he got away from himself, and I think it's good to almost like the analogy I think of is like a shooter, you know, just like a Duncan Robinson type 3-point shooter or whatever it is. Just seeing a couple balls go through the net, right? Like, just I think having a month here where your approach comes back to you, you're recognizing spin better, and then you bring him up with some momentum instead of kind of throwing him into the deep end again, fight or flight, opening day, all those butterflies. I think this will be a better way for him to kind of just fly into the big leagues with momentum.
I heard you mention Nick Ahmed. Do you have any thoughts on Nick Ahmed right now?
I think he's going to be the shortstop. No, he's going to be the shortstop in San Francisco. Look, the second that signing went down, I thought it was a tell that the Giants are, you know, being realistic with what the reality is of Marco Luciano. And we've talked about him on the call up. I think it's harsh because he's been hurt and things like that. But if you look at the body of work for Marco Luciano, he has not really put together a complete season.
Statistically, it's not good enough to warrant the prospect ranking, to warrant the to cue in pop culture, the Lisan Al Gai, like the Messiah idea, that he is the savior of the San Francisco Giants. He was really good at a really young age. Since then, point me to the year where he has proven that he is a top 20 prospect in the game.
I can't. And if you look at like the stretches, right, he dominated rookie ball at 17 years old in 2019. Then you get him up to, you know, in 2021, low A, 19 years old, puts up a great year. They bring him up to high A, by the way, that year, gets dismantled. Like, not even competitive. 37% K rate in 36 games, 59 WRC plus. Okay. 2022, banged up most of the year. Ends up finishing pretty well, high A, 121 WRC plus in 57 games. Then this past year, we get him in double A, slightly above average numbers, whiffing at a 30% clip. They bring him up to triple. He really struggles. They bring him up to the big leagues. He really struggles. He's never really done it for a full season, both health-wise and just putting it together consistently offensively. And I do wonder if he never hit that home run off of Ryan Rolison that went viral during, you know, really COVID time.
Yeah.
They were just practicing on the backfield. That 118 mile per hour home run that was like heard around the prospect world times 10.
Yeah.
Does he get the same amount of hype? He gets a lot of hype because he was a top international free agent. Again, he was putting up really good numbers at the lower levels. And he is still just 22. But again, he's never really put it together. And he was given a lot more credit before he really did anything. Credit to him for improving the defense and becoming at least an average defender at the position.
Yeah.
It's not like he's proficient there either. I think the Giants are realizing that, you know, if it's going to happen, he's going to have to be a late bloomer, and to count on him going into this year, probably not the move. Sounds like Nick Ahmed might make the team, and Casey Schmidt might be getting some more reps at shortstop too.
So maybe their two highest build hitting prospects last year, both made their major league debut in Marco Luciano and Luis Matos, and one of which earned it, one of which performed too well at the AAA level to be held down in Sacramento. One of them felt optically forced to the major league level.
Yeah.
And I bet you can guess which one felt optically forced. Matos did not light the world on fire at the major league level. You got to go back to the drawing board with Matos a little bit, but Luis Matos earned his way to his major league debut. Marco Luciano works incredibly hard. I'm not saying that he didn't earn his major league debut, but statistically speaking, he did not seem ready to be a major league shortstop. And in spring training now with 9 punch outs in 14 plate appearances, do I have that right?
I think so. I mean, I saw a few of them myself when I was in Arizona, and then, like, you know, I was sitting open side, like right behind home plate, just to the right.
So he's one for 14 he's one for 14 with nine punch outs in 16 plate appearances.
And you know, that comes on the heels of like a very similar type of performance in the Winter League as well.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, he got blown up in the Winter League. So I'm rooting for him. He's still just 22. He's got time. But if we're talking about top prospect Marco Luciano, if we're talking about, you know, a guy that can be a factor for this team this year, I'm betting on Luis Matos any day of the week to be a contributor for them. And by the way, finished the Winter League 0-16 with 9 Ks before I think he just stopped playing out there. So it's been a struggle for him, and I haven't seen a tangible adjustment swing wise or setup wise or anything. It's kind of becoming the definition of insanity here, at least Einstein's.
Yeah. One more shortstop that I want to mention here real quick is O'Neill Cruz with the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I saw our friend of the program, Foolish Baseball, put out that he feels like the hype around O'Neill Cruz has gone away entirely. And frankly, I agree, because like this guy, you know, he breaks his leg, he shatters his leg in that, you know, collision with Sebi Zavala at the plate in April of last year, and he misses the entirety of the year. And then you have Ellie Mania come, and he's the switch hitter, and he's the top prospect in baseball. It's almost like you got the better version of O'Neill Cruz. O'Neill Cruz is back. He did something that has been done very few times in the StatCast era, and I'll give you these numbers. He had an 116.6 mile an hour homer in the first inning against the Phillies on Sunday. Then in the second inning, had an 114 mile an hour homer. There have been five instances before O'Neill Cruz in the StatCast era where a guy has hit two homers at 114 miles an hour or harder. That list, Matt Davidson, kind of weird, 2018, Giancarlo Stanton twice, Nelson Cruz, and Aaron Judge.
Emily did it in AAA, I think, too.
Did he do it in AAA? Okay, yeah. So you got that going. The thing that jumps out about O'Neill Cruz, he now has 21 plate appearances under his belt in spring training. He has hit three homers. He's struck out three times.
That's big.
We might be seeing this guy, now fully healthy again, enter his breakout year. And I saw a tweet about sprinkling on him to win MVP. Don't do that. Don't get ahead of yourself, because he's going to have his defensive struggles. He committed an error in that game on Sunday. But man, like, this guy can absolutely go 40-40 this year. He's that type of alien life form player.
Yeah. I mean, they're it's so weird that they're both like very similar in a lot of ways, O'Neill and Ellie De La Cruz. And I think that's why, being in the same division, they're going to get a lot of comparisons. But, you know, O'Neill's had a lot more reps hitting-wise. And I think if you look at who's probably a little bit more advanced from the hit tool perspective at this point, I think, you know, O'Neill Cruz is a little bit better with the pitch recognition. He's starting to, you know, not do the swing over the breaking ball wave at it. Because when you're 6'7" or Ellie's 6'5" with just ridiculous levers, like, you're going to – generally get longer, and you're generally going to swing over those breaking balls because you've got to start everything earlier. And you can almost close your eyes and picture it. How many times have you seen O'Neill wave over the breaking balls and Ellie wave over the breaking balls? But you're seeing O'Neill now stay back on those, or at least you'll have some adjustability to be able to poke that out or just leave it. And I think Ellie will get there too. But remember, O'Neill, though hurt last year, has just had more time, more reps, and has more time to reflect on his MLB struggles when he did struggle, and seemed to be building on it already last year. That's the other thing too, is like, before he got hurt, we were like, oh, here we go. I think it's starting to come together for him, and then boom, he gets hurt, which made it hurt that much more. I think they're both going to be phenomenal, but I think O'Neill was already putting it together in terms of the polish side.
I love the point you make just there, because 2 months in, I remember like 6-8 weeks into his big league career, I checked on it and he was hitting under 100 against breaking balls. And then it's not a night and day switch. Like, he's not hitting 350 against breaking balls now, but hitting like high 100s compared to sub 100 against breaking balls.
Yeah. Which is all he needs, because he pillages fastballs.
Yes. All he needs is like a 180 clip against breaking balls. That's it. We're just asking him not to be an 080 clip against breaking balls. And he may be at the stage in his career where he can do that effectively. Ellie is not there yet, understandably so. O'Neill Cruz, I love the point you just made, has had a chance to sit on his major league struggles and correct that. And I think we will see a new and improved O'Neill Cruz this year with the freak tools that we know he's got.
Baseball is more fun that way. So yeah, Ellie and O'Neill in divisional matchups, especially, you know, the Pirates are going to be good soon. It's starting to come together. That talent's matriculating. You're going to have a young core in Pittsburgh, a young core in Cincinnati, and then they both have their alien life forms that they push forward right in front of everybody and kind of lead the way. And I think it's just going to make for a really fun rivalry in the Central that I don't think anybody would have expected a few years ago.
No, and then you've got Skeens and Green that are kind of Spider-Man meme on the hill, and then you got Jared Jones, who's a freak, sitting 100 again.
You hope Lodolo is healthy. Like, there's a lot of fun young talent on both those teams. Again, I hope there's contention there too in a healthy way, and I hope we get a nice little rivalry brewing there in the Central.
100%. I want to turn to the Marlins real quick before we get to Pat Bailey. AJ Puck, dude, he's going to be a starting pitcher, and he looks freaking nails in spring training.
I never thought we'd see this one. I'll be honest, when I heard them talk about it in the offseason, I'm like, what are we doing here? Off an injured reliever, we're going to move him to the rotation and see how it goes. But command has never been a major issue for Puck. It's been mostly health, and it's been mostly a third pitch. But now he's running a four-seamer out there, and I actually watched him on the backfields make all of the Marlins' best hitters look insanely dumb.
That's what he can do, man. Like, that's what he was doing out of the bullpen before the All-Star break last year.
Yep. And now he's added this splitter, and he's added this cutter. I forget who said it, but someone whiffed, and I'm standing back there, and I just hear one of the Marlins starters go, "He has a cutter now?" And you could just see everyone was just bewildered. And then you go through the game so far. I mean, the last outing against the Nationals, 3 1/3, 5 hits, no runs, 1 walk, 6 Ks. Before that, against the Yankees. And this was a lot of good Yankees hitters in this lineup that day. Yeah. 3 innings, 1 hit, no runs, 2 walks, 6 Ks. And then the other outing was 2 innings, scoreless, 1 walk, 3 Ks against the Braves. He's sitting 94, and he threw 64 pitches. Can't tell you the last time. I actually can tell you the last time he threw 64 pitches. But he has not thrown that many pitches in a long time. I mean, it's been really just trying to manage him workload-wise just to be able to throw an inning every couple days. So the fact that they can stretch him out now, he's holding velocity. They said he's recovering well. He feels good. With Edward Cabrera going down now, potentially, sore shoulder, not only is Puck going to be in the rotation, I think he might be pretty darn good. My only concern, Jack, and I'm curious what you think, and it's hard to speculate on injury, but is this kind of like a churn and burn, like, you know, Peter Bendix Rays type of thing, where it's like, yeah, injury is probably inevitable, whether he's in the bullpen in the rotation, might as well get the most out of him now. That's my only concern.
I think you're building out your bench right now, and like, you're building out your backup plans in the rotation. Weathers looks really good in the spring, and Max Meyer has looked healthy. So you have this assortment of Puck, Weathers, Meyer, and you've got Trevor Rogers coming off of injury as well. You know, like, you hope that they can kind of fill out the rotation without Sandy and with Cabrera being as finicky as he is. And hell, man, Sixto Sanchez might have a spot in that bullpen. Like, it is.
Can you believe it?
No, I can't. And 96.1 from Sixto Sanchez in early March of 2024. Couldn't freaking believe it. But I do think that Peter Bendix and Skip Schumacher might be building out their depth right now. And AJ Puck should be at the top of that rotational depth.
It's just wild to me, like, that this is even a possibility as well. And again, I if he holds up, that's great news, because he does fill up the zone. Four-seamer now working that sinker in. He's filled the zone up with that. Slider's nasty. Having a splitter in the cutter as well. This guy can give you a lot of looks. So I think the goal is he can keep them afloat at least first few times through the rotation. Then you have Braxton Garrett coming back, who's going to get a late start from the shoulder. But if Puck's healthy and he's throwing, I mean, look, we saw Cole Reagans off double TJ all of a sudden have this magic moment where he's throwing 100 miles an hour and healthy and recovering for now, which is great to see, and I hope it sustains. And, you know, that's a first-round talent. Puck was a first-round type talent who's just been derailed by injuries. Maybe he has this second life here. But I am concerned about the workload. Hopefully he can stay going. And for the Marlins, I think they're probably already kicking themselves for not trading Edward Cabrera, considering that every single year he has a shoulder ailment or soreness or something around this time. It's every single time. So, I mean, I don't know why they didn't try to cash in, but I get it with some of the guys banged up in the rotation.
For sure. Two more quick things before we get to our conversation with Patrick Bailey, the Giants catcher. Joey Votto is back in the big leagues. He's a Blue Jay. I will say my only thought on this, like, welcome back, Joey Votto. Really hope that this guy has the end to his Hall of Fame career, in my opinion, that he wants. If he does make an appearance in the regular season with the Blue Jays, that TOR at the bottom of his baseball reference page is going to look really weird. And it's not going to take away from his Hall of Fame candidacy, but it doesn't help. Like, I find it interesting. I am glad that Canada's favorite son gets the chance to play for the Blue Jays in spring training. He could be a Buffalo Bison. He's going to give it another go, and round of applause for him.
Yeah, you know, at least he gets to do it at home. I think it, you know, usually people like to have the player in one spot his whole career. I think this is one of those exceptions where you can say, he pretty much was. He did the retirement year with, you know, his home area. Right. I don't know where. Canada's a big place, but I assume he's
Is an Ontario guy.
Yeah. But regardless, I mean, it's the one team in Canada, and I know he takes pride in that. So, you know, I mean, regardless, I think it's a cool way to finish out his career, and hopefully he gets a little bit of run. I always like checking in on milestones to see if, you know, anybody's close to anything when they've got, like, kind of this last hurrah. He's not really at all close to any specific milestones. So, yeah, that's the one thing. Maybe he is close to surpassing somebody on a list of something, but there's not really, in terms of, like, the numbers, there's not really any number that he's super close to. But that said, it would be cool to see him make the team. I just struggle to believe that he's a better option than Dan Vogelbach at this point. And it is crazy to say that. But, you know, you look outside of that little fever dream stretch he had for a couple weeks, like, he was one of the worst hitters in baseball. And I hope he's good. And I would love to see him in, like, the what they imagine the Brandon Belt role to be. But again, wouldn't Dan Vogelbach just be better for that at this point? But who knows? Maybe Votto gets his body right. He's able to stay a little bit healthier this year, and he can just be that power lefty off the bench. That would be awesome. I would love to see his final year. He's just Matt Stairs, comes in, hits clutch homers, and just is electric for, you know, this Blue Jays team. I would love that more than anything. Yeah. But again, Vogelbach being there, Votto's probably going to be playing in AAA. And he's probably going to put a lot of butts in seats, which will be really cool. You know, he's not a guy that has too much pride to do that. That whole team that he's going to be a part of is probably going to get a lot of nice things from him and a lot of great meals because he's a great guy. Yeah. And then if they need anybody, he'll be right up there. But he doesn't strike me as the kind of guy that has too much pride to just have some fun in Buffalo and mentor guys and then come up when he gets a shot.
Man, he spent a long time in Louisville last year, and he is set. He felt kind of rejuvenated by the group in Louisville because at the beginning of the year, it was Ellie De La Cruz, and it was Matt McClain, and it was CES. Like, he was with that group that matriculated. I'm not saying Damiano Palmigiani is Ellie De La Cruz, but, you know, like, you got some good hitters that are going to be there.
No, there's fun guys over there.
It looks like Aurelvis and Barger are going to be there, so it could be fun to kind of foster the next generation of Blue Jays pitchers. And if Tiedemann's there, that would be, you know, awesome to have one of the best hitters of this generation kind of watch a start and break down Ricky Tiedemann with Ricky Tiedemann, which would be great.
Sorry, go ahead.
He's just been so hurt. Like, I hope he's healthy.
That's it too. You know, because I still feel like when he's healthy, he can be that. He can be, you know, I know he never was a three true outcome guy. I never whiffed that much, but he could be a three true outcome, you know, replacement slugger. You know, I think he could still run into baseballs. But I was going to say the reports were out of Cincinnati that it was a conversation that Votto had with Will Benson on, like, the team plane that really helped Benson get his mind in the right spot and really helped him, you know, have the performance that he had and break through after a sluggish start to his big league career with the Reds. So, you know, Votto has that kind of ability and that kind of impact. And again, I think the Blue Jays see him as just a mentor, almost like a built-in coach. And, you know, if he can give them something on the offensive side, if they need it, that's great. You know, if Vogelbach continues to struggle, then yeah, you've got another option there. But, you know, I think at the very least, they feel like they've got a coach here in Votto.
Speaking of the Reds, guess who David Bell announced as the opening day starter?
Wouldn't it? Oh, Frankie Montas.
Frankie Montas.
Oh, dude, they're buzzing about him out there, huh?
I know. Charlie Goldsmith had it.
I was going to say Hunter Green, and I'm like, you wouldn't have asked me that question.
Nope.
They're buzzing Frankie about Montas. He must look great.
I guess. Wow. Shout out Charlie Goldsmith for having
Yankees fans punching air.
Oh, God. They're so good.
I would love to see Montas just shove.
It would be so much fun.
I would love that.
Same way I wanted Gallo to rake as soon as he left. Like Montas.
I don't think they didn't really get a chance to boo Montas because he was never really on the mound. Yeah. I'm sure if when they get the opportunity, they will.
Yeah.
So if that is the case, then I would love to see him shove.
Duke Wake this past weekend. Duke Wake Forest. We saw Jonathan Santucci and Josh Hartle go head to head on Friday. Then we saw Chase Burns punch out 14 on Saturday. Did we see the first two pitchers off the board this weekend in that series? Or, I mean, shit, dude, Hagen Smith is
Hagen Smith's putting up some dumb numbers right now, dude. Some crazy, crazy numbers. But, you know, I have some of the just the numbers from that Chase Burns start. We definitely saw the top arm, which is Chase Burns.
Yes.
Ran it up to 101. It broke triple digits if you don't round up three times. But, you know, if you round up from 99.5, he hit that six times. Just ridiculous stuff from Burns. It was fun to watch the Santucci start and also see, you know, Hartle, who's going to be an arm that's probably late first, maybe early second. But it also was a great reminder of how fucking good Chase Burns is, because Santucci, some view is potentially the number two arm in this class. I think right now it's Hagen Smith, but Santucci struggled a little bit, right? Hartle got knocked around a little bit. Then Burns, aside from a solo shot, just knocked every hitter around with it. It just overpowered them. Yeah. And it was a different game. To me, this really solidified that Burns is the top pitcher in this draft. And I don't think it's particularly close.
I like that he showed his nut job side again, because I'm sure everybody remembers the throat slash that he had coming off the mound at Tennessee. Like, we knew he was a nutcase in the best way. And he had like a nutcase moment in that game. He can rise to the occasion. And I'm very excited to see this guy pitch in big moments for the next 15 years.
How many swinging strikes do you think he had?
So the average high on a given night in Major League Baseball is like 15, 16. He threw 95 pitches. Is that right?
99.
He threw 99 pitches. Is he over 20?
26.
God. Okay.
And it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 on fastballs. The rest on sliders.
Yeah. Well, his slider has been like 90 to 92.
That's just disgusting.
Yeah.
That psycho scream, like nut job walk off the mound. I was like, this guy is built for it.
He's got it.
And I will say, though, this was a preview of what I think is going to be a really fun ACC battle, probably ACC tournament final. Mm-hmm. Duke can play. There's a lot of fun players in college baseball right now. But, man, Chase Burns, it's funny. You know, most of the best pitchers are usually Friday. I think, you know, Wake didn't want to mess with it. Hartle's been their guy. It's been this way, kind of the three in a row. If it's a Saturday, check if Wake Forest is playing. You won't regret watching this guy pitch. Even if you're not a huge college baseball fan, if you like this sport at all, you will get a lot of enjoyment out of watching Chase Burns do his thing.
100%. All right, we're going to talk with the backstop for the San Francisco Giants, Patrick Bailey, in just a moment. Before that, quick break.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
We welcome on San Francisco Giants catcher Patrick Bailey to the Just Baseball Show. Pat, thanks so much for coming on, and I'm really excited to have the conversation. How's spring training going?
Going good. It's going good. I feel like, goodness, we're 3 or 4 weeks into it now. Freaking flies by, and only got a couple more weeks left, but so far so good.
What's the adjustment? We ask Grayson Rodriguez the same thing the other day, and I'm really fascinated from the catching perspective too. What's the adjustment for you, or like what's some differences maybe as your first spring training coming off of a big league season now as a catcher?
Yeah, it's definitely a little different. In previous camps, you know, you're trying to really make a name for yourself and earn a spot, and now that that's kind of changed, you kind of have a opportunity to kind of focus on the relationships you're building with the pitchers and the pitching staff, and kind of continuing to develop that is kind of what we worked on during the season. And kind of if anyone showed up with some new stuff, and then just kind of the goals that we're trying to do as a staff and each individual arm. So it's definitely a better feeling for sure. But yeah, it's been new and it's been fun so far.
How was that adjustment coming up from the minor leagues, right? Because you played 97 games and you put up one of the best defensive seasons in Major League Baseball in such a short amount of time. So to go from the minors to the majors, not being able to have that spring, what was it like to just kind of get dropped in there with a whole new pitching staff?
Yeah, I mean, luckily, I think I had three big league camps before. So I had some familiarity with Webby and Cobb and obviously Keaton and Kyle Harrison getting called up, Ryan Walker. So I had some familiarity with a lot of the staff and did a really good job of kind of preaching what our philosophies were. And so I had a really good understanding of kind of what the Giants were trying to do from a pitching side. but obviously getting right into it, you're trying to build that trust as fast as you can with Cobb and Webb and, you know, our staff and relievers. And so that was kind of my main focus, getting called up and just trying to get the best out of them and kind of earn their trust. Cause kind of once you have that, then you can start rolling.
You mentioned some new stuff from guys. Has there been anything or any new pitches or something you could tease maybe from some of the guys on the staff that you've seen in the early going here that, you know, maybe Giants fans can get excited about? I know it's kind of like new pitch season where people are always getting overexcited about certain things, but when the guy who's actually catching them is able to talk about maybe a new pitch or something that looks a little bit different, then yeah, I think it's time to get a little more excited about it.
Yeah. I mean, we got some guys throwing some cutters. I think Kyle had a cutter last year. We're just trying to kind of refine it and figure out what we're trying to do with it and what areas we're trying to exploit with hitters' weaknesses and whatnot. And then Keaton, I think he's came into camp, been able to spin it a little bit better. So we're hoping to get something that kind of can move away from the right-handed bats to take some pressure off the split and the fastball. No, Webby's just continuing to do what he's doing. He doesn't have to change much. And obviously Cobb's still doing his thing. He can wake up and want to learn a new pitch, and it's the nastiest pitch ever. It just determines on if we want to throw it or not. So he's a fun guy to be around.
Is the cutter coming in more of an organizational thing, right? Did the Giants want to implement a cutter to most of their pitchers, or was that a case-by-case basis that you just felt when pitchers came into camp that a lot of them were trying the cutter?
I think it's a case-by-case thing for sure. I don't know if it's an organizational thing, but I feel like a lot of pitchers, if they don't have a cutter, it's like, yeah, let me mess around with this and see how it is. I don't want to say it would be an easy pitch to learn because I'm not a pitcher. I think it depends a lot with kind of arm slot and, you know, if they're more supinated or pronation biased. So yeah, I wouldn't say it's an organizational thing.
When did you start to feel like you had a knack for handling a staff? And like, I want to get into the actual, you know, fundamentals and defensive side, just in terms of being able to handle a staff and everything that goes into it and realizing that, hey, I'm actually a guy that can, you know, help pitchers get the most out of themselves. Like, was that something that you started to realize maybe in college, or did that start to happen for you in the minor leagues or even later?
Yeah, I think it was sooner. I think it was in high school, kind of having the travel circuit and whatnot. I didn't have like any of the big invitations for Perfect Game and Under Armour and all that fun stuff, but I was able to make the USA team, and I couldn't hit a lick. Like, couldn't hit it at all in high school. But I made the high school USA team. So that's kind of when I figured out, I was like, all right, like, I can have a lot of value behind the plate. I can bring a lot of value to a team for what I do defensively. And as a catcher, that kind of starts with your pitchers, you know, like if you can be able to get the best out of them, that's going to help me stay out there. That's going to help the team get wins. And so that's really when I had the first understanding. And then thankfully the bats come a long way as well. And just kind of try to continue to progress on all of that.
And speaking about, you know, the early parts of your career, you grew up in Greensboro, North Carolina. You were drafted by the Twins in the 37th round, but instead of going straight to the big leagues, you decided to go to NC State. Wondering what led to that decision, right? You're playing on Team USA, you get drafted by a big league squad, but you decided to go to NC State.
Yeah, I mean, I think I kind of forget I get drafted there. I think Twin Scout called me. I was like, hey, we drafted you. Don't think it's going to come to anything, but remember us in a couple years. So it's just kind of a funny conversation, but picking NC State, relatively easy. You know, I wanted to play in a Power Five conference, so that checked the list. There weren't a ton of catchers that were recruited, I guess, in the same time frame as me there, so it was kind of not a super full catching room. And then, you know, they've had some success behind the plate with, you know, guys like Brett Austin, Andrew Kisner and whatnot. So I was excited about that. And then Elliot Avent was one of the best people I've ever been around, still is to this day, have a great relationship. And he really felt like it was kind of their honor for me to come play there, which meant a lot to me. And it was a really good experience there. Nothing but great things to say about NC State and Coach Avent.
You put up great numbers there, though, too, and you talked about how the bats come a long way. Obviously, what you were able to do there made you, you know, a middle of the first round pick, really closer to the top 10, and a lot of success in the early parts of your minor league career as well. But just really being able to see it click on another level and start to produce at the big league level. Where was the point where you started to see the offense translate? Because you're also a switch hitter. I'm interested to ask you a little bit about that, but you know, where did you start to realize like, hey, I can hit enough to play at the big league level?
Yeah, I mean, the hitting really didn't come until my freshman spring. I had a terrible freshman fall. It's actually laughable, just, you know, what a joke about got or joke about it around the players and whatnot that I used to play at NC State with and the coaches. But that spring, I think just finally kind of physically maturing, getting in the weight room and whatnot, building some strength. I think that helped the most, just being able to hit the ball harder. And then, you know, being able to have success in the ACC in college kind of gives you that confidence. And I think that's when I started like, all right, like I can swing the bat a little bit. I can do what I need to do at the plate and combine that with what I can do behind the plate. It's like, all right, I think you got a chance here.
With the stick, it does seem that when the lights are bright, two outs, runners in scoring position, you're the man. You have an 801 OPS last year with two outs, 969 OPS with two outs, or excuse me, a 969 OPS with runners in scoring position last year, and then a 920 OPS with two outs and runners in scoring position. What about the bright lights do you love? You just seem to rake whenever the game's on the line.
I don't know. Just trying to slow the game down, not trying to get too big. Sounds like I need to do a little bit better when runners aren't in scoring position. Cause those are some good numbers. I guess I need to just imagine runners at second and third, but no, I mean, just trying to breathe, relax, not trying to do too much, give what the pitcher takes me, all that fun stuff.
I'm always fascinated by switch hitting catchers, because it's just amazing in general just how much that goes into the job of catching. You know, of course, talking about what everything you've already hit on, from handling a staff and then the things that go into to slowing down the run game and blocking and receiving, and then just whatever's left is what you can do on the offensive side. But someone like you, you got two swings to worry about as well. And what's interesting to me is in the 2022 season, you know, in the minor leagues, you were much more productive from the left side. And then in your big league stint, you're actually more productive from the right side. Is there a side of the plate that you've been, you know, more comfortable with through the years? And is there any reason why that you could think? I know it's a small sample size at the end of the day, but why you were, you know, much better from the right 23 versus 2022?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like it depends on the day whether one swing feels good or the other. Sometimes they both feel good. Sometimes they both don't. But I think going into this year, I mean, when I got called up, I was basically like, from the right side, I'm just going to put up good at-bats. I'm going to try to simplify things as much as I can. I'm going to try to hit the ball up the middle, like really, really simplify it as much as I can. Swing at strikes, take my walks. And I think that was probably the biggest difference for me from the minor leagues to the big leagues from the right side. Just a lot of simplicity. A lot of pressure was taken off, I guess, the bat when, you know, I got called up. I knew that if I wanted to stick, I needed to catch. And that was, again, kind of my value was coming from there. When you're in the minor leagues, it's kind of, you know, a lot of times you got to hit your way up the levels. So I think for the most part, I put a lot of pressure at the plate in the minor leagues, and where, especially early on in the big leagues, I was like, all right, like what I can do at the plate's a bonus. I'm going to do what I can behind the plate to, you know, help us win games.
Do you feel like catchers generally in the minors have to kind of hit their way up a little bit because there's not as much maybe in-depth data and things like that? I know teams have it at the end of the day, but there's just a different level, I feel like, when you can get to the big leagues and then all of the advanced stats and just how elite you are in so many different departments. Like, do you feel that like that's part of it? And then the second prong of that would be, did you realize, I mean, I knew you obviously knew you were always a good defender, but did you ever realize that you could be one of the best in the big leagues right away?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll answer the first one. I mean, you can have an understanding of what a guy can do behind the plate. And it's just, I feel like it's just kind of how it is where, you know, if you hit, you get called up. You know, I think the game's growing to where it's kind of, all right, what is this guy doing overall as a player? How's he in the field? How's he doing at the plate? How's he base running? All that fun stuff. And then that kind of determines, all right, where's this guy going to be? How's he going to get caught up and whatnot? So that's exciting to see. And then secondly, I would say I knew I could be one of the best in the big leagues behind the plate. That's kind of what I've always done. That's what I've been known for. So I had the utmost confidence coming up, knowing what I can do and receiving wise, throwing, needed to block better than what I did last year. But and then just working with the pitching staff, like that was what I was the least worried about.
Where does this confidence in yourself come from? Because it illuminates on the field. You can see it right as the moment you stepped on the field, the field general, right? It felt like I was watching like a young Chris Paul. Right from the NBA. Where does that confidence stem from?
I guess just doing it for a while. I mean, I feel like I try to slow the game down as much as I can behind the plate and at the plate as well. But if I can be a stoic, a tranquil presence, no matter what's going on, where, you know, pitchers, position players, like you're always looking at the catcher. If I can be that sense of calmness behind the plate, I feel like that's always a bonus. And yeah, so that's kind of what I'm trying to emulate.
I think one of the more, I wouldn't say misunderstood, but I think just like lack of general knowledge around the position is the catching position, where, you know, fans just don't really totally know what goes into every little piece of it. You talk about receiving and blocking and all the little things, but what is it that makes a certain catcher just so much more proficient at receiving? You know, blocking makes sense. It's athleticism, sliding, moving around a little bit, but I want to key in a little bit more specifically on receiving. You know, what makes a catcher so proficient with their receiving? And how much of that do you think is teachable and I guess developmental versus just something that you have?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm still trying to figure that one out myself. Obviously, I mean, you need good, quick hands. For me, I think a lot of it stems from just your prep work, kind of call it relaxation before the pitch. You know, as a hitter, you're trying to match the shape of a pitch. As a catcher, you're trying to do the same thing. So if a slider is breaking to my right foot, I'm trying to relax my glove outside of it so that when I come up to catch, you know, I'm not trying to move the pitch, but the work I did before catching the pitch allows it to be a quick motion, and super fluid, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does. And how much that goes into that would be, I guess, knowing the arsenal of your pitchers as well, right? Because you mentioned knowing the shape of it. Like, do you put a lot of time into obviously just catching bullpens and things like that, but just even extra time into knowing the exact movement patterns of each of these pitches so that you can get yourself there, you know, before the ball gets there, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's all of it. Like, that's a great point. You watch a catcher and you can kind of get an idea of how comfortable they are with the pitcher. And that's a big thing for me in spring training is kind of seeing all the shapes again, catching the new guys, figuring out what their pitches are doing. A lot of times the hardest ones for me are like the big misses. Is the backup breaking ball? Is it backing up? Is it still moving? You know, if they really yank it glove side, like how much more is that moving? Is the sinker still getting that horizontal run glove side? Is it more arm side, you know, this, that, and the other? Cause again, like the shapes play a huge role in it and you really got to match the move with your glove with what the ball's doing.
That comfort level with the pitcher was taken to the nth degree in what I think is quite possibly the greatest game ever framed. You, Alex Cobb. Now it was a near no hitter. But in that game, 28 called strikes. And I watched every pitch of that game. There was a lot that you were lying to the umpire. And what I mean by that is you were pulling it right off the black, right into the strike zone, and the umpire was giving it to you. It was pure art watching you and Alex Cobb just work through that lineup. Can you walk us through that game and that experience? Because at a catcher, right, it's your rookie year. Alex Cobb is on the mound. I'm sure it gave Giants fans, you know, memories of when Matt Cain and Buster Posey were there too. Can you just walk us through the near no-hitter and what I think is the greatest game ever framed, or at least close?
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's a tough one to go back to. You know, I think a couple nights after that game, I remember waking up and I was like, man, we threw one too many splitters. So I always kick myself for that. I think he threw the most splitters ever in that game. But you talk about getting called strikes. I mean, whether they're off the plate or on the plate, like Cobb's always throwing it where he wants to. I mean, you're getting more called strikes if you're hitting your spot. And he's always putting that splitter right below the zone. He's backdooring the sinker to righties. He's front hipping it to lefties. He's going in the righties. I mean, he can do more than a lot of pitchers can, and it's really fun to work with him out there. You know, he can backdoor a curveball like it's nothing, just on the corner, just off the plate to the lefty. So, you know, it was a super fun game. You know, one out away. I felt for him bad, and you know, maybe we can get it done this year.
What does it feel like in the ninth inning when you got that line? I mean, what's that feeling like?
That was probably the most intense locked in I've been on a baseball field. Like, gut was turning a little bit. It's kind of undescribable, how you feel. And everyone on the field can feel it. Everyone in the stands. You know, Slater caught that ball on the eighth with two outs, and you know, every no hitter has like that catch, that play. And so I was like, oh man, like there it is. You know, we had that catch, we had that play, like, you know, this is gonna happen. Sure enough, it didn't, but it was a really cool moment to be a part of, for sure.
Is there a specific pitch type that you feel like is just more conducive to being able to steal strikes for you? Like, is it those splitters at the bottom of the zone that you're able to pull up? Is it, you know, maybe something breaking the other way that you're able to kind of frame on the outside or inside? Is there a certain pitch that you just feel you can just kind of sell a little bit more?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, change up, splitters are moving down, so I would say those are probably just below the zone. You know, backdoor sinkers that have that sharp action late. You know, Webby and Cobb do a great job of that, getting those. You know, late breaking sliders just off. I think a lot of it comes from pitchers and how well they do really filling up the zone. You see it in a game. A guy comes out, it's not throwing strikes, walking guys. They don't get the borderline pitches. If guys are filling it up, if they're throwing strikes, if they're hitting their spots, you tend to get those edges, and you tend to get the, you know, the two strike breaking balls just off that, the pitch before he, you know, dotted a backdoor two seam and whatnot. So I think it's a combination of the pitcher and the catcher. And yeah, I mean, the more strikes guys throw, I feel like the more strikes the umpires like to call.
Is there kind of a pitcher, because right, you can go from an opener, maybe with Ryan Walker, over to a guy who's handling the middle innings all the way to Camilo Duvall. Is there one guy, and maybe it is Camilo Duvall, that it's just kind of a pain to frame for because he's throwing 102 miles an hour?
I would probably say Tyler Rogers. Mm. He gets probably the most egregious calls. Just because it's funky. Like, it's funky for hitters, it's funky for me, it's funky for the umpire. I feel like that's like all we talk about when he throws. So, you know, he gets misses out of the zone, but he also gets a lot of strikes called balls. So it kind of goes both ways with him. Duvall, man, he, I feel like for the most part, when he's filling it up, like, it's, you know, it's a lot of fastballs, relatively middle up, and then breaking balls kind of back foot to lefties and kind of just off to righties. So I feel like he's good. I mean, Ryan Walker's tough. He's a tough guy to catch, but that's just because he's throwing from left center field and throwing 96 and he's got a sweeper at like 20. So he's nasty, but I'd say Tyler Rogers out of that group for sure.
How much have you studied like TrackMan data now, and just again, just knowing the ins and outs of, you know, what makes a pitcher effective? And I have some friends that, you know, either were former catchers, retired, and now working for teams that, you know, are just, have taught me so much of what I know that about what goes into pitch shapes and what makes, you know, what do what. Like, is that something that you've always been fascinated by, or, you know, as you became a professional, realizing that that could be something that really makes you better at your job? Like, is that something that you're always diving into on the data side?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I've always been invested in kind of how pitchers work, how pitchers get outs, what makes them click, in high school, college, and then from the TrackMan side, that really happened in pro ball. Just talking with, you know, the pitching development side, the pitching coaches, the pitchers, really figuring out, you know, what shapes we're looking for, the tilt, this, that, and the other. Because for me, like, I go back to, all right, what makes Logan Webb good? What makes Kyle Harrison good? And for me to understand that, I got to know what makes them good. And TrackMan usually does a good job of telling you that. And so I think it's like, it's probably the best cheat sheet you could have, where you don't have to go, you know, obviously you want to see how it plays against hitters, but you can usually tell if, it's a plus pitch on TrackMan, it's probably going to be a plus pitch against hitters, because there's a reason that, you know, TrackMan or the analysts see it as a good pitch. And so, you know, you're wanting to pitch off that. So I think it's very important for, you know, for catchers and for me to have an understanding of TrackMan and the data. And, you know, I try to hang out with our analysts as much as we can. Pretty smart people.
You obviously have, you know, you're crazy detailed, whether that be in the data on the field. You know, we have, you know, some coaches who listen to this podcast, you know, younger players, and I'm sure if they could ask you a question about a couple of tips, whether that be framing or locking down the run game or blocking, what are maybe some few things that you wish you could tell your 12-year-old self or your 15-year-old high school body?
Yeah, I think one thing that I wish I would have understood earlier is quality is a lot better than quantity. You know, as when you're 12, 13, 14, you can take 300 swings and they all feel good, but you know, how many of those swings are really quality? And that's probably my biggest, I wouldn't say regret, because it kind of built that foundation of hard work. But, you know, I always think back to like, man, what could it have been if those swings were maybe with more purpose, or if those swings were, you know, dialed in a little bit more, if it was less swings, but better intent. So that's where I'm trying to get at now, is really maximizing my, I guess, efficiency and work, where, you know, every swing I take in a day is, you know, I want it to be relatively game-like or with high intent, so that I'm not just going through the motions. And then same thing, you know, catching wise, just when I'm putting in work, I want it to be at the highest level. And yeah, I think that's big. And then, you know, catching, you know, catch as much as you can as you're young. Catch bullpens. I think that was the biggest thing that helped me when, you know, I was 12, 13, 14. I went to this place called the North Carolina Baseball Academy in Greensboro. Scott Bankhead, he pitched like 10 years in the big leagues, did lessons there. And whenever he had a high school or college arm, he didn't want to catch. He called me and say, hey, come catch this guy for me. So I called probably hundreds of bullpens. And I think that's kind of where I developed a confidence behind the plate. And then also just an understanding of pitching from, you know, listening to him and what he's telling the guys.
That's awesome. That's really cool. And it's one of those things that I think a lot of kids are like, yeah, I don't want to go catch that bullpen. Like, I don't feel like doing that. Usually players will be complaining about that, but you know, it's an opportunity to get some reps in. The last one for me is just kind of your focus going into 24 and what you are, you know, kind of hoping to improve and build on. Obviously it was an incredibly successful season for you. A really exciting rookie year where you've solidified yourself as kind of the future behind the dish for this Giants franchise. What are you building towards now going into 24?
Yeah. A big one for me is continuing to develop the relationship with the pitchers, old guys, new guys, just figuring out what makes them click. You know, keep getting better receiving, throwing. Want to be a much better blocker this year. I didn't think I did a good job of that last year. Not good enough. I think I can be better. And then hitting, just being more consistent. You know, I was super happy with some of the success I had, and kind of gives me the confidence that knowing I can do this at the highest level. But the last couple months were tough, and just need to figure out how to keep those cold months, make it a cold week, make it a cold 2 or 3 days, and then grind out ABs. I think a lot of that will come just from nutrition in the weight room. I lost a lot of weight last year. And so this year I've put it back on. I've probably in the best shape and strength wise I've been, and big emphasis for me is just keeping my weight on and keeping just being able to be at my best in August, September, October.
Really appreciate you coming on, my man. This was a great conversation, and I'm really excited for you next year, right? Because you played 97 games. You put up a 3-win season immediately. Can't wait to see what you do in 24, my man.
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.